Hi, I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now! For more than 15 years, CJSF 90.1 FM has been bringing Democracy Now! To the greater Vancouver area every weekday at 11 a.m. This is Democracy Now!
It's a genocide that's taking place that you people don't want to write about.
60 white South African Afrikaners have arrived in the U.S. after being granted refugee status, even as the U.S. suspends refugee resettlement for almost everyone else in the world. We'll go to South Africa to speak with an Afrikaner journalism professor whose new piece is headlined Trump's Fake Refugees. And we'll speak with a black South African political analyst about race, power, and the politics of distraction. Then Palestinians mark the 77th anniversary of the Nakba, when some 700,000 Palestinians fled from or were violently expelled from their homes as Israel also carried out massacres upon its founding. Many Palestinians say they face a second Nakba today.
Despite all of the circumstances, we are maintaining our land and rooted here. Our right of return will never be forgotten, and Palestine will always be Palestine.
We'll speak with a Cornell University professor, lead author of a major new report released by U.S. academics called Apartheid in Israel, that concludes Israel's treatment of Palestinians meets the legal threshold of apartheid. And as Israel's brutal assault continues, we'll also look at a Starvation in Gaza report with Alex DeWall, author of Mass Starvation, The History and Future of Famine. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Officials in Gaza say Israeli strikes have killed over 100 people in the past day, the majority of them children and women, as Palestinians grow increasingly desperate in their daily struggle for survival more than 10 weeks after Israel cut off all imports of humanitarian aid, including food and medicine. Thousands were seen fleeing Gaza City after the Israeli military once again issued forced relocation orders, among them sick and wounded patients at Al-Shifa Hospital who were left to fend for themselves in Gaza streets.
My daughter was admitted to the hospital as a result of the siege, starvation and malnutrition. We do not know where to go with the patients. We are fleeing from one death to another. We are dying slowly. Everything we have is over. We are dying 1,000 times every day. Until when will this let down? Until when is this siege? Until when is this weakness in our nation?
Israel's brutal assault on Gaza continued as Palestinians commemorated the 77th anniversary of Nakba, which is Arabic for catastrophe, when some 700,000 Palestinians fled from or were violently expelled from their homes by Israel's founders. This is a Palestinian resident of Ramallah who joined Nakba Day marches in the occupied West Bank.
Despite all of the circumstances, we are maintaining our land and rooted here. Our right of return will never be forgotten, and Palestine will always be Palestine.
Human Rights Watch is condemning Israel's plan to demolish Gaza's remaining civilian infrastructure while concentrating the Palestinian population into a tiny area. HRW said such actions would, quote, amount to an abhorrent escalation of Israel's ongoing crimes against humanity, ethnic cleansing, and acts of genocide, unquote. Adding, quote, Israel's blockade has transcended military tactics to become a tool of extermination, unquote. On Wednesday, activists with Taxpayers Against Genocide delivered a complaint to the Inter-American Commission on Human Rights in Washington, D.C., calling on the U.S. to follow its obligations to prevent genocide under the American Declaration on the Rights and Duties of Man. Huwaida Araf is lead attorney in the case.
Because when you support genocide, you basically violate every right that's guaranteed in the American Declaration, which the United States is held to. The first and foremost among them is the right to life.
President Donald Trump again called for the U.S. to take over Gaza and turn it into what he called a freedom zone. He made the comments earlier today from Qatar as he continues his tour of the Gulf states. On Wednesday, Sheikh Tamim Al Thani welcomed Trump for an official state visit with a lavish ceremony. During his visit, Trump announced Qatar had agreed to deals with U.S. companies worth close to $250 million, including worth over $240 billion, including a $96 billion deal for Boeing to sell hundreds of jets to Qatar.
From Boeing, that's the largest order of jets in the history of Boeing. That's pretty good. So that's a record, Kelly. And congratulations to Boeing. Get those planes out there.
The White House says Trump still plans to accept the $400 million luxury jet from Qatar, known as the Flying Palace, to replace Air Force One temporarily, despite bipartisan criticism, including from Senate Majority Leader John Thune and other top Republicans. NBC News reports the cost of converting the plane could take several years at a cost of over $1 billion. Trump is traveling to the United Arab Emirates today for the final leg of his Middle East tour. In Virginia, Georgetown University scholar Barakhan Suri has united with his family following his release on bail from a Texas ICE jail after a federal judge Wednesday ruled his detention violated his rights to free speech and due process. Khansouri's release comes 1 week after Tufts scholar Ramesa Osterk was freed from a Louisiana ICE jail and 2 weeks after Columbia University student Mohsen Madawi was released from ICE custody in Vermont. Federal agents abducted Khansouri outside his home in Virginia in March, separating him from his three children and his wife, a U.S. citizen of Palestinian descent. Khansouri is a peace scholar. He recently wrote from behind bars that he'll, quote, leave no avenue unexplored in defying the witch hunt unleashed upon me and others who believe in freedom for Palestinians, he said. The U.S. Supreme Court's hearing arguments today on a case stemming from Trump's plan to end birthright citizenship. The Trump administration's challenging the power of federal courts to rule against Trump's executive order and to impose nationwide injunctions. In other news from D.C., Homeland Security Secretary Kristi Noem told House lawmakers she backed the idea of suspending habeas corpus to carry out the Trump administration's mass deportation agenda. At the hearing, California Democratic Congressmember Eric Swalwell blasted Noem for refusing to disavow President Trump's use of a photoshopped image of a tattooed hand, which Trump claimed is proof the expelled Maryland father, Kilmer Abrego Garcia, was an MS-13 gang member. This is part of their exchange.
You are one of the chief law enforcement officials in the country. What have you done to investigate whether the president misrepresented the reason that that person has been detained?
Sir,
have you done anything to try and figure out whether that was doctored or not?
The mission of the Department of Homeland Security is to secure our nation and to make sure that we're out there going after those that are the worst of the worst, the criminals, the bad actors. Abrego Garcia.
So the answer is you've done nothing to correct the president.
In related news, National Intelligence Director Tulsi Gabbard has fired two senior officials who oversaw the National Intelligence Council's report contradicting Trump's rationale for invoking the Alien Enemies Act to expel alleged members of the Venezuelan gang Tren de Aragua without due process. In other immigration news, the Trump administration said it's charging Harvard scientist Xenia Petrova with smuggling for failing to declare frog samples while she was traveling. Petrova was detained in February and transferred to an ICE jail in Louisiana. She faces political persecution if deported back to her home country of Russia over her protests against the Russian invasion of Ukraine. Petrova is a highly skilled scientist whose work could lead to major advances in early cancer detection.
A Russian delegation has arrived in Turkey for the first direct peace talks with Ukraine in over 3 years, but the delegation does not include Russia's President Vladimir Putin, nor its foreign minister Sergei Lavrov. Instead, several of Putin's deputies are attending. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky called Russia's presence decorative as he arrived in Ankara today. Zelensky had challenged Putin to negotiate a face-to-face peace deal. Shortly after Russia's announcement, the White House said President Donald Trump would also skip the peace talks. On Wednesday, officials in Ukraine's northeastern city of Sumy said a Russian missile attack on an industrial site killed at least three civilians. The German charity Sea Watch reports two children, aged 3 and 4, died after a rubber dinghy carrying refugees from Libya to Italy broke down and was stranded in the Mediterranean. The children died of dehydration. One other person drowned in the journey. Another 59 passengers survived. In Libya, rival militias traded fire Wednesday in the capital, Tripoli, just hours after a truce had been called following the worst fighting in the area for years. The clashes broke out Monday following the killing of the leader of a powerful armed group that's been accused of major human rights abuses in Libya's migrant detention facilities. At least 6 people were killed. Libya's ruled by 2 main authorities, while armed groups vie for control over Libya's natural resources. A UN-recognized government in Tripoli is led by Prime Minister Abdelhamid Ghiba, while a rival administration in the east of the country is controlled by Khalifa Haftar and his Libyan National Army. Here in New York, the federal sex trafficking and racketeering trial for 90s hip-hop star, business mogul Sean Diddy Combs is underway. On Wednesday, his ex-partner, Cassie Ventura, detailed Diddy's intense physical and sexual abuse during their relationship, including how he forced her to participate in hundreds of drug-fueled sex parties he called freak-offs. Ventura also told the court Diddy raped her after their relationship ended. Jurors were shown a video of Diddy beating and kicking Ventura, dragging her on the floor of a Los Angeles hotel outside an elevator in 2016. Sean Diddy Combs is accused by multiple women of sexual assault, trafficking, and exploitation over decades. He was arrested in September. If convicted, he faces a possible life sentence. Congressional Democrats grilled Health and Human Services Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr. in back-to-back hearings in the House and Senate Wednesday. Kennedy defended major cuts to HHS as part of the Trump administration's efforts to dismantle federal agencies, insisting key programs would still operate without offering any concrete plans. He was also questioned about his response to the growing U.S. measles outbreak and his vaccine skepticism. This is an exchange with Congressmember Mark Pocan.
If you had a child today, would you vaccinate that child for measles?
For measles? Probably for measles. What I would say is my opinions about vaccines are irrelevant. I have directed Jay Bhattacharya.
Sure. No, like I said, I don't want to.
So that everybody can make that decision. But I don't want to seem like I'm being evasive.
Yeah.
But I don't think people should be taking advice, medical advice, from me.
Peace activists disrupted Kennedy's Senate hearing, leading to their forced removal and the arrest of 7 protesters, among them Ben & Jerry's co-founder, Ben Cohen.
Poor kids in Gaza by buying bombs and pays for it by kicking kids off Medicaid in the U.S.
RFK Jr. is ordering the FDA to review regulations around the highly prescribed abortion pill, mifepristone, citing a new study that experts have called fatally flawed and junk science. The ACLU said Kennedy's trying to, quote, make it harder for people to get medication abortions based on propaganda pushed out by a Project 2025 sponsor, unquote, while leaving the final decision on the matter to Trump. The ACLU added, quote, we should all be scared if our access to safe FDA-approved medications turns on President Trump's gut instinct rather than credible scientific evidence, unquote. In another blow for abortion rights, South Carolina's Supreme Court has upheld the state's 6-week abortion ban, which outlaws nearly all abortions. And House Republicans have successfully pushed through proposals that would slash Medicaid and food stamps as part of Trump's budget, making his 2017 tax cuts for the wealthiest Americans permanent by taking away essential services for the rest of the country. The measure could leave more than 8.6 million people without health care over the next decade. Some Senate Republicans have voiced concerns over the bill, namely that it doesn't include steep enough spending cuts. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman.
And I'm Nermeen Sheikh. Welcome to our listeners and viewers across the country and around the world. South African President Cyril Ramaphosa says he will meet with President Trump at the White House next week after a group of some 59 Afrikaners arrived in the United States Monday after being granted refugee status. Afrikaners are the white South Africans who ruled the country during apartheid. This comes as the Trump administration has suspended refugee resettlement for almost everyone else in the world. Speaking Monday, Trump claimed white South Africans face racial discrimination, even though the country's white minority still owns the vast majority of farmland decades after the end of apartheid rule. Trump said he's allowing them to come to the United States to escape, quote, genocide.
It's a genocide that's taking place that you people don't want to write about, but it's a terrible thing that's taking place. And farmers are being killed. They happen to be white, but whether they're white or black makes no difference to me. But white farmers are being brutally killed and their land is being confiscated in South Africa.
On Monday, South African President Cyril Ramaphosa refuted Trump's claims that white people are being persecuted in his country, calling it, quote, a completely false narrative. On Tuesday, Ramaphosa recounted a conversation he'd had with Trump about the situation in his country.
I had a conversation with President Trump on the phone, and he said, what's happening down there? And I said, President, what you've been told by those people who are opposed to transformation back home in South Africa is not true. And I added to him, I said, we were well taught by Nelson Mandela and other iconic leaders like Oliver Tambo on how to continue to build a united nation out of the diverse groupings that we have in South Africa. We're the only country on the continent where the colonizers came to stay, and we have never driven them out of our country. So they are staying, and they are making great progress. It's a fringe grouping that does not have a lot of support, that is anti-transformation and anti-change, that would actually prefer to see South Africa going back to apartheid type of policies.
This comes as South African-born Trump advisor and multi-billionaire Elon Musk has also accused South Africa's government of promoting what he calls white genocide. Musk's grandfather moved his family to South Africa after embracing the country's apartheid system.
On Wednesday, Musk's artificial intelligence chatbot, Grok, became a trending topic on X when people tried to use it to answer questions and check facts. And the chatbot added the topic of white genocide in South Africa to its responses, telling users it was, quote, instructed by my creators to accept the genocide, quote, as real and racially motivated, no matter what the question was. For more, we're joined in Cape Town, South Africa by two guests. Herman Wasserman is with us, professor of journalism, director of the Center for Information Integrity in Africa at Stellenbosch University. His new piece for the website Africa is a Country is headlined Trump's Fake Refugees. Wasserman himself is a white South African, an Afrikaner. And Andile Zulu is a political analyst with the Alternative Information and Development Center. His new piece for the website Africa is a Country is titled Race, Power, and the Politics of Distraction. We welcome you both to Democracy Now! Herman Wasserman, let's begin with you. You are a white South African and you are an Afrikaner. If you can explain, first of all, to the world what exactly that means and what you thought when you heard President Trump charge white genocide in South Africa.
Well, I would say that my first response was one of incredulity, and later met with, you know, I think I met with disgust even, and just rejection of this notion of a white genocide or whites being persecuted. And I think that view is shared by many others, white South Africans, and certainly the majority of South Africans in the country.
Well, Andile Zulu, if you could also respond to this, these claims of a white genocide in South Africa and Trump bringing over these 59 Afrikaners to the U.S., and talk about this in the context of this the new law that replaces the 1975 Expropriation Act in South Africa, and explain why that's been so controversial and what it entails.
Well, this accusation of white genocide emanating from the White House is a conspiracy theory and a myth that has been floating around echo chambers of right-wing populists and white nationalists for many decades now, particularly within the online space. And it essentially holds the accusation that white South Africans, in particular Afrikaans South Africans, are victims of deliberate, direct, state-sanctioned violence. And anyone who lives in this country, who's awake to the reality of this country, the inequality, the poverty, the unemployment that most Black South Africans have to endure, and including Indian and colored South Africans as well, knows that it's patently untrue. And the truth, however, is irrelevant to those who are perpetuating this myth. What matters is that it's a means through which you can mobilize anxiety, mobilize fear, and mobilize frustration from a segment, I think a relatively small segment of the population that is dissatisfied with the post-apartheid democracy and the loss of their political elevated status. It's a way in which you can mobilize fears here in South Africa and then appeal to a base within the MAGA movements in the US as well to portray the Donald Trump presidency as essentially being a crusader to defend white civilization, both in the USA and here. And this all began initially with the signing by the president, Ramaphosa, of the Expropriation Act, which in itself is not that much of a radical or progressive policy. It's a very procedural piece of legislation, which essentially changes the criteria through which government can expropriate private property for the public good and for the public use, on the basis of finding just and equitable compensation. And in fact, most legal experts have said that the instances in which you'll arrive at nil compensation, at no compensation, would be quite rare, actually. So this legislation isn't an assault on white livelihoods. It isn't even an attack on the dominance of private property relations in post-apartheid. But for Elon Musk and for Donald Trump, it's doing what right-wing populism, what racial ideologies always function to do, which is to stoke fear, conflict, and division in order to be able to protect the exploitative and unequal relations under South Africa's neoliberal capitalism, and I think under the neoliberal order that we have more broadly.
And Andile, I mean, I just want to add these a couple of things that I wanted to say earlier, which is to clarify for audiences who aren't as aware of South Africa's history. It was a 1913 law that gave over 90% of South Africa's land to whites. Today, they are some 7% of the population are white South Africans, but they still own about half, 50% of the country's land. Afrikaners, who constitute the majority of the white population, are among, of course, the most successful and richest in South Africa. So if you could explain, Andile, how has this news, Trump's statement, the fact that these 59 people have now arrived in the U.S., how has that been received in South Africa, this news?
I think it's been a mixture of frustration and bewilderment and just real confusion as to what is the basis of the idea that white South Africans, in particular Afrikaners, are being persecuted. And as you said, South Africa in the post-apartheid, the past 30 years of democracy that we have, comes out of a history of a white supremacist regime, which not only dispossessed people of color of their land, but also then set up a rigorous economic system of exploitation to ensure the underdevelopment of Black people, Indians and coloreds included, to be able to amass economic and political power. Now, if you just look, for example, at the statistics that we have on the racial manifestations of inequality in this country, it's quite clear that this myth of white genocide and of white persecution has no basis in reality. For example, the unemployment rate amongst white South Africans sits at 7.9% as compared to 36.9% for Black South Africans. The poverty rate for white South Africans sits at 1% as compared to 64% for South Africans. And in fact, the people who are the victims of violence by and large due to organized crime and due to the symptoms of societal dysfunction are largely young Black men and young Black women. If you are a young Black person in the place where I live, in Cape Town, and you live in a township in a rural area, you are 16 times more likely to be a victim of homicide as compared to a white South African. But however, it's just important to clarify that white South Africans, of course, because we are all living in a country that has many issues and many crises, are still, of course, victims of violent crime, of state dysfunction, of economic anxiety and of financial precarity, but they are not victims of those things but because they are white. Those issues are a symptom of a larger dysfunction due to an incapacitated state run by kleptocrats trying to enforce neoliberalism on an increasingly dysfunctional economy. So it's quite important to say that the myth of white genocide has no basis in reality. However, South Africa is facing crises, the three crises of mass unemployment, of inequality, and of poverty. And those result from the choices, the bad policy choices that the ANC has made since 1996, which is essentially an abiding commitment to neoliberal policy, the kinds of policies which are causing the crises that we see in the United States and in many parts of the world as well.
I wanted to go back to Professor Herman Wasserman. Here in the United States, powerful group of men around Trump, known often as the PayPal Mafia, co-founders and members of PayPal, extend to apartheid South Africa. Its members, Elon Musk, co-founder of PayPal, with Peter Thiel, along with David Sachs and Roelof Botha. So you have this situation where most refugees in the world are not allowed into the United States right now, where refugees are being thrown out of the United States. But you have this group on Monday of 59 white South African Afrikaners arriving in the United States after being granted refugee status. Can you talk about this small group around Trump and what they mean for Trump's worldview right now and what it means that these refugees are brought here? Did it get much attention in South Africa? I shouldn't say refugees, but these white South African Afrikaners.
Yes, I think many South African media outlets refer to these refugees in inverted commas because I think that is the general understanding that they are not really refugees. As you have pointed out, it flies in the face of the really dire and tragic circumstances that many people around the world live under and that would be much more eligible for refugee status. In fact, as Andile has pointed out, this whole refugee status is based on disinformation. It's based on a disinformation campaign. And so some of it, it's hard, of course, to pinpoint exactly what happened first. And one could argue that some of these former South Africans around Donald Trump would have had his ear and would have maybe helped him tap into this sort of narrative of white persecution. They also represent to him maybe white South Africans who have left the country and have sought their fortunes elsewhere. And, you know, but I think what is also important to recognize is that this has also been the result of a concerted effort by some Afrikaner lobby groups over many years to fan that idea that South African, white South Africans, especially Afrikaners, are being persecuted. There have been a consistent campaign by the Afrikaner rights group AfriForum, who have been pushing that narrative for many years. They have lobbied Washington. They have met Republican officials. They've appeared on conservative media outlets like the Tucker Carlson Show. They've extended their road shows to conservative think tanks and conferences in Europe, like CPAC in Hungary. And in all these places, they painted a dire picture of South Africa, where white farmers are supposedly under constant attack, where they're singled out for violence. They are on the verge of losing their land, that they are unfairly being targeted by a corrupt and totalitarian government, which discriminates against them in what they would call a type of reverse apartheid. And all of this was very deftly wrapped up in a communication strategy that then eventually found sympathetic ears among U.S. conservatives. And I think with these men around, white former South Africans around Trump, which would have amplified that to him. And now with this so-called refugee campaign, their communication